About London equations, and we wrote down the conjecture that that London made about how the supercurrent flows. And rather than worrying about things like gauge invariance of the supercurrent, let's just go ahead and use this relation to calculate the fields, and that way that stuff all goes away. So the question is, what does this mean if the supercurrent density is proportional to the to the vector potential? And so this immediately implies the two London equations, which I'll write. Actually, I should reverse the order of these, but let's do it this way. So you remember that the magnetic field, that usually called the B field, but I guess it was Tinkham adopted this notation that what he calls H is the microscopic B field, which is to say that B is some average of H over a region that smooths out the microscopic behavior or something like that. But in any case, it's curl of A. And so if you calculate the curl of JS, then that is minus E squared NS over MC times the local magnetic field. And similarly, if you take the time derivative of this equation, you get the electric field, which is minus 1 over C dA dt. And that's equal to M over E squared NS DJS dt. So look at the second equation first. What's that telling you? What it's telling you is that the time rate of change of the current is equal to the electric field. Okay? So applying an electric field causes the current to, if you like, accelerate. And that's what you would get for free particle-like motion. Okay, if you apply a force to a massive particle, its momentum increases. Its momentum increases in time. Okay, so that's telling you that this supercurrent acts as if it was like free particle-like. So that's one idea that's contained in this relation. The other idea says that the curl of the supercurrent is a magnetic field. That's what leads to the screening currents. Okay. So for instance, let's just go on. So this says that the field from Maxwell, the curl of H is equal to 4 pi J over C. And so if you take the curl of both sides of this equation, see, on the right-hand side, what am I trying to say? That the oh, I see. So this implies, just this, implies that the curl of H is equal to 4 pi over C curl of JS. Just taking the curl of the screen.
Yep.
This from this.
Yeah.
This is taking the curl of this equation, and this is taking the time derivative of this equation.
But if I take the time derivative of 1 and take the coil of 2, I simply get some equation.
So what does that say? That says that those equations are consistent?
That's all.
Okay. You're saying if you take the time derivative of this and the curl of this?
Yeah.
Because those are consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. But each one of these says something separate.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, every time you operate with a differential operator, don't you lose information? I mean, it's like, I think the point is that this says that the curl of J is the magnetic field, and this says that the time derivative of A is the electric field is the time derivative of JS. And there's different, I mean, they're related because Maxwell's equations are consistent with each other. I mean, I don't think that's, yeah. I mean, there's,
well, it simply means that equation 1, 1, and 2,
well, they're both coming from the same equation.
Right.
I mean,
because equation 2 is simply Newton's law.
Equation 2 is
Newton's
law.
Newton's law.
I mean, the observation that you're making is that, the observation you're making is that if you take the time derivative of this and the curl of this, then that's simply as, and that they give you the same result.
Yeah.
Isn't that like saying that the time derivative and the curl commute? Isn't that? Because you're starting with the same equation, you're doing the same two operations in a different order. But I do think they actually commute. So, isn't that right? So of course you get the same result. But anyway, it's all true. Okay, so so this thing here is just this is just L squared H. And this thing here is, according to the London equation now, is proportional to H. I guess this is minus del squared H. Minus, yes, 4 pi over C, putting in what del curl of JS is, which is E squared NS over MC. H. And then I can just cancel the minus signs. Yeah.
So when you write something like that, where A is a H, it can be positive.
Right.
It's like on a magnetic morph one.
I don't know about the magnetic monopole,
but I think that the assumption here is that actually you're working in a
specific gauge.
Yeah, which is the one that, which is the so-called London gauge, which is that the if A equals zero and then A goes to zero inside the sample.
I see.
Okay, I think that's the assumption. But these equations are, of course, gauge invariant. So this relation says basically that the magnetic field will decay going into your sample on a length scale, lambda L, which is called the London penetration depth. So if you look at the field, the component of the field that's parallel to the surface of your sample, its magnitude decays exponentially and this length scale is lambda L. Okay. And the important thing is that a large NS implies a short penetration depth, or small penetration depth. Yeah. H of x, it's the distance into the sample. So if you have a sample, you have some sample in a magnetic field. The field is expelled from this region . So the field is zero inside. It decays to zero in a penetration depth. And then the question is, what does the penetration depth depend on? And the answer is, it depends on the density of superconducting electrons, which is also what the size of the supercurrents scale with. Okay. So basically, well, this is with the appropriate constants. Okay. The London equation that says that the curl of JS is proportional to the magnetic field, coupled with Maxwell's equations, tells you that the field decays exponentially going into the sample. Okay. And this, so physics, yeah, Peter.
The mass, is it always going to be the same mass, or like if you include some kind of interactions, is that going to be some kind of effective mass?
No.
the reason I'm hesitating is that there's some weird statement that's attributed to Shen about the mass that it's irrelevant what its value is, that it could be the mass of the Earth and you get the same result. But I can't for the life of me remember what the context is for that. Okay. I mean you can see as you develop a microscopic basis for superconductivity that the effective charge is 2 electron charges, and then you might think that the effective mass is 2 electron masses, and they might be the effective mass. Okay, but things quickly become complicated because this NS is somewhat undefined here as to what it means. See what I mean? So these are both effective quantities. It's actually NS over M, which is entering in here. And but the charge is actually fundamental. As it turns out, it's 2E. It's twice the electron charge. Let me think about that a little bit more. But one thing I did want to tell you is empirically what the size of this is. So experimentally, is something like 100 It can be more, of course. If you have a very, very poor superconductor, it can be made arbitrarily large. Okay, but for your typical superconducting materials, this is on the order of 1,000 angstroms or so, a good superconductor. So that the fields are actually excluded except in a very rather microscopic region near the surface. So these superconductors have a lot of oomph to them. Okay, so I hope everybody's comfortable with this, that if you have del squared h going like h, that this thing decays exponentially. Okay. Now, so this is a little bit strange. Yeah, Felix.
Is there any situations where the exponential growth solution is?
The other side? Going out of the sample? I don't think so.
Okay. In a quantum mechanics, you tend to throw away the exponential growth, but sometimes you can
I don't know
find situations where it
that would.
You may have different solutions when you can see the thin films.
Okay.
For example, or set samples of finite size. So they're both solutions.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I said. When you get to the other side, it goes back up. Or a piece of it there. Okay. So this is a very strange situation here. You put this thing in a magnetic field, and the field can't get into the sample. You might say, well, maybe you should just wait. Eventually, we'll get into the sample. The current will slow down, something like that. But that's not what happens. It actually is just kept out. This is a thermodynamic state of the system. And as you all know, thermodynamics means forever. Right? So the point is that this current doesn't decay. So it lasts forever, basically. And so the question is, how can that happen? What does that mean? Okay. So There's a way of looking at this, which I wanted to, you know, sort of expound on here a little bit, as to how you can imagine that the current would not be able to decay, would just continue flowing forever. When that could happen, and when it doesn't happen. Okay, because most of the time it doesn't happen, right? Most of the time you start a current in something and it decays it stops. Okay, so let's consider so there's your pipe, and inside the pipe you have JS. Flowing. And so the question is, what does it take to slow down? Okay. The idea is that this thing here is cold. In principle, the walls are rough. They're not like perfectly smooth. And so basically, this means that this can absorb energy and momentum. So normally, flowing down through this pipe, the walls will randomize the momentum and cause the current to decay. It can also absorb the energy because it's cold. And it's connected to a refrigerator, if you like. And so the way that happens is that, well, so if you were moving along with the supercurrent, you'd be in the rest frame of the superconductor. The supercurrent would be like represented by the ground state wave function in its rest frame. Okay, and you would expect that to be fine. Okay, but the question is this: these walls would like to excite excitations, which allows it to. It would like to, for instance, create excitations, which it can then. Which carry some momentum in the other direction, for instance, and slow the thing down. So the idea is that this superfluid, which is moving along in its ground state in its own rest frame, it has its own excitation spectrum, and the question is. How does the wall create excitations? Okay. Now, the wall is in thermal equilibrium in the lab frame. Okay, it's at some temperature T in the lab frame. Okay, and so then the question is how does this wall absorb energy as it changes the momentum of the fluid? So the point is that what you want to do is you want to look at the excitation spectrum of the superfluid in the lab frame, in the frame of the pipe, of the walls. And so from the point of view, so the question is, well, first of all, you might say, okay, what is the excitation spectrum of the flowing fluid? And actually what I wanted to do is contrast the behavior of four types of quantum fluid. Okay, so let's consider and so those will be the non-interacting Bose gas. The Bose superfluid. Of which, for instance, superfluid helium-4 would be an example. The normal Fermi liquid. And 4 is the superconductor. So in the so in case one, at low temperatures you have some macroscopic condensation into the zero momentum state, and your excitations your excitation spectrum is quadratic in the rest frame of the Bose gas. And so then the question is what does this look like from the point of view in the rest frame of the pipe? In the rest frame of the pipe, it actually looks like you've Bose condensed into a state which is moving with some velocity down the pipe. And the excitations are Doppler shifted. So that their excitation, let's just write it. So here, okay, I'm going to use slightly different notation here. K. Actually, I don't have to. Let's use P. Okay, so this is some excitation viewed from the perspective of the pipe. Okay. And the point is that if you create an excitation whose momentum is pointed opposite to Vs and small, its energy will be negative, which means you can do that, and the energy will be soaked up by the wall, the cold wall, and the momentum will be soaked up by the inhomogeneous surface which excites that excitation. That way. Right. And it will slow down. Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. So if it wants to create excitation. If you're in the frame of the cold wall, your excitation spectrum looks like this, right? No, it's the other way. Vs is that way, and the energy of this. No, the wall. So the question. No. It wants to. The point is that the wall can supply momentum, but not energy. Okay, so the wall can give you.
The fluid is rushing by, and it's going to kick excitation down the way.
But it's the same thing. The net effect is that you slow down the fluid.
I don't think it's right, though. It's the other way around.
Okay. I think that that you're absorbing. The point is that that it creates excitations at zero energy, essentially.
Yeah.
And it absorbs. It generates momentum, if you like, in the opposite direction, and slows it down, and it absorbs the energy.
Okay. I think the answer's going to be the same.
I think, I think you're right. Okay. But the point is that you can create excitations without it costing you any energy. Okay. But which have finite momentum. That's the point. And
we'll get the line of sight straight.
Right. Okay. So that's what happens in the non-interacting Bose gas. It doesn't act like a superfluid. That's the bottom line. So case two is actually the simplest case is called the weakly repulsive. Bose gas. That's a simple case. And the point is that the effect of repulsive interactions between the Bose particles changes the excitation spectrum. And it changes it from being just particle-like to being like sound waves. In other words, having a linear dispersion relation. So in this case, epsilon p, or epsilon of p, let's see, you could write it as cp, where this is the speed of sound. And so that's just linear. And if you look at this from the rest frame, you look at these excitations, assuming I've done this right, the Doppler shift, the effect of the Doppler shift is to tip the spectrum, so the ones going that way look like they're moving faster, actually, right? The ones going that way look like they're moving slower. But the point is, regardless of the sign, that all of these excitations are at positive energy. As long as Vs is less than the speed of sound, it costs you energy to create these excitations, and the cold pipe doesn't do that. Okay? Because it can't supply you with energy, it's only a sink for energy. So that's the big difference between the non-interacting Bose gas and the weakly interacting Bose gas. This acts, the interactions allow the gas to act like a superfluid. Okay, so that's for bosons. Okay, and that's why superfluid helium or condensed, BC, condensed cold atoms in the condensate that are bosons in the condensate can have superflow. Okay, it's this essential difference in the spectrum that if you have linear, you can support superflow, and if it's quadratic, you can't. It will just radiate excitations and decay. Okay, so the next question is, what about fermions? So, so here, the excitations of the non-interacting or normal. Actually, I should say, or normal Fermi liquid. It's the same thing, and that was the whole point of the normal Fermi liquid. It has the same kind of spectrum as the non-interacting Fermi liquid. And that is the excitations, if you like, let's call these particle hole excitations. There's a I'm trying to think of the right way to write this. I wasn't actually planning to write this. So here, to make an excitation, you have to excite something from below the chemical potential and create something above. You excite a hole from below you excite an electron from below the Fermi surface to a state above it. But the point is that you can do this at infinitesimal energy. Okay, so there's no. You can do this at infinitesimal energy, and you can do it with arbitrary momentum. You can always find a hole, take an electron over here on the Fermi surface, and move it up above infinitesimally above the Fermi surface over here. So you can basically generate arbitrary amounts of momentum with zero energy excitations. If you then Doppler shift this into the rest frame, there's tons of excitations at negative energy that will, absorb momentum or generate momentum. Okay, so I didn't actually draw any pictures for this, but this is like the worst case. This is the case that will slow down immediately. Okay, this is related to the fact that these Fermi liquids are very viscous. So this is easily. I guess the reason why this is a little bit harder to draw because there isn't a unique excitation energy for every momentum. There's a whole range of particle hole excitations with different energies and the same momentum and vice versa. Okay. And the fourth case is the superconductor. And here, what we're going to see is that that the excitation spectrum in the rest frame of the superconductor we will show goes like something like this, h bar squared k squared over 2m minus mu plus delta squared. So the point is that there are no low-lying excitations. This is gapped. Okay. So to create excitations in the frame of the moving superconductor requires a finite amount of energy called the energy gap. And if just because it's moving, if you Doppler shift that a little bit, it doesn't do much at all. You've still got this gap. Might be a little bit smaller, but it's still there. Yeah. This is the velocity that the superfluid is moving at.
Do you think, like in regular conductors, the speed of electrons is like completely tiny? And it's like almost, they move the
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's like absolutely.
The actual current, yeah, yeah. So it's,
yeah, so it's the same thing. You have like Vs, it's the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, basically there's an awful lot of electrons in the supercurrent. And to get a given current, the velocity, the actual velocity, doesn't have to be very large.
Yeah,
but on the other hand, I mean, if you have a weakly interacting gas, you know, sounds like a very small tube. Okay, so it's I mean, this comes from the interaction, repulsive interaction from a low density gas. So I forget what the crippled, I mean, the other case, is superfluid helium 4, which is not a weakly interacting Bose gas, but nevertheless has all these properties for more or less the same reason, because the excitation spectrum in the superfluid state has some linear slope to it, and there's some velocity which you can actually exceed with superfluid and superfluid helium 3. Okay, so it's possible to drive it so that it's anticipated. Yeah. So in a sense, if you like, the superfluid velocity for a given current depends inversely on the density of the superfluid. See what I mean? So I mean, think about it from this point of view. Say you're applying a field to your sample. There's a certain amount of current that you need to keep the field out, and that's an absolute amount of current in amps or whatever. Okay. So if you've got a large density of superconducting electrons carrying the current, they don't have to move very fast to screen that field out. But if you have a very bad superconductor with low density, then that superfluid has to move very fast to keep that same field out, and so it's easier to destroy it. See what I mean? So you can make big fields too. So anyway, okay, so yeah, this argument is always a little bit needs to be thought about and explained carefully. But the bottom line is that the ability of some fluid to support a supercurrent depends sensitively on the spectrum of its excitations. And if they have enough restoring force in them, such as a something that supports sound waves or something that supports has a big gap like a superconductor does, then it can sustain superflow, because it's not possible to create the elementary excitations that would cause the current to decay. Okay, so that's there's one last property of a superconductor that I wanted to mention, and that's the specific heat. And this is something which is easily measured in a superconducting material. And basically, the way that it looks is this. Remember, the specific heat for a degenerate Fermi gas is linear in temperature. So it's gamma T. And that's what happens when you come down in temperature in a metal. But then when it becomes superconducting, what's observed, at least in the classic superconductors, is a jump and then a decay. So this is the specific heat, so-called specific heat jump. And maybe you can't see it in here, but this actually becomes exponential and the thing up in the exponent is the superconducting gap. Okay, so I told you that if you have a superconductor, its elementary excitations require a finite amount of energy to generate. That's called the superconducting gap. That naturally shows up in the specific heat, because as you go down to low temperatures, the excitations are disappearing exponentially. Okay. So you can measure the gap, if you like, if you can measure the specific heat at low temperatures and do a log, semi-log plot and look at the slope, you can get out the superconducting energy gap. And in fact, all of the thermodynamic properties of a superconductor that has a gap like this will have these exponential low temperature behaviors that reflect the gap.
Like ethereum, barium, copper oxide?
To the extent that I've written it, more or less, yes. But the difference is that in mercury, this is independent of K, of the direction of K. And in the ones, the ceramic things, this actually has is highly anisotropic. It actually, there are certain directions in which it vanishes.
So this same kind of theory works both for, let's say, metals and then for ceramic things that will look and feel completely different?
That have superconductor?
Yeah.
Have superconducting states? Yeah, but the details will be different. In particular, for the ceramic ones, like I say, there are what they call nodes in the gap. In other words, there are directions on the Fermi. So this gap is a gap, if you like, in the Fermi surface of a metal. The Fermi surface of a metal is the highest occupied state, and it separates occupied from unoccupied, and then there are infinitesimally small energy excitations where you move the electron from below to above. Okay? In the case of a superconductor, that whole Fermi surface is what they call gapped. In other words, the excitations in different directions in momentum space still require this energy delta in order to create them. Okay. In the case of the high PC superconductors, as you look in different directions on the Fermi surface, they're actually two-dimensional, so if you look around the circle, there are some directions in which the gap actually vanishes, other directions where it has its maximum. And that will affect the thermodynamic properties, because you can see this delta is different for different directions in momentum space. And so you get some more complicated temperature dependence. Actually, you get power loss. Yeah.
The argument you've just given, if you try and make a superflow in the direction of the zero in the gap, it should decay.
Actually, I think that you have a linear, effectively, your density of states, I think it doesn't, actually. I think it acts more like
linear.
It's more like the
superclassic super.
It's more like the classic. I think that's pretty much the case. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, bottom line is there's a thermodynamic transition to a new low temperature state, which is gapped, supports superflow, and expels magnetic fields. So this is not your standard Fermi liquid. That's really the bottom line here. And so the question that you want to ask is, what could possibly give rise to this new thermodynamic phase? And a natural possibility is that it's the result of electron-electron interactions. Because we know electron-electron interactions can do a lot of different things. And so maybe they do this and cause the state to have these properties. So then, that unfortunately doesn't get you very far, because as you know, the problem of interacting many-body systems is not solved in any generality. So I just want to point out one thing that we actually talked about before, about electron-electron interactions and how they play out in the Fermi liquid. And what we said was that because of the fact that you have this filled Fermi C, and because of the form of the electron-electron interactions, that they conserve momentum and things like that, that the phase space for scattering is very restricted. In fact, I think I argued that in two dimensions, if you have an electron or a quasi-particle here at P1, and you have a quasi-particle here at P2, and they scatter off of each other, they actually have to conserve their total momentum, P1 plus P2. So there's actually not a heck of a lot they can do. Okay? In three dimensions, they can actually scatter around a circle here where they keep the same total momentum, but they change the direction of their relative momentum. Okay? But in two dimensions, there isn't much they can do except exchange. And so you might want to think about this case. So this is restricted phase space for scattering. So you might want to consider the interaction of electrons with equal and opposite momenta. Because if their total momentum is zero, and so they can conserve momentum and scatter, and energy for that matter, and scatter into this, P prime and minus P prime, or in fact, they can equally well scatter into this, P double prime and minus P double prime. Or anywhere, any direction they want to go. Okay? And so many possibilities. And as my colleague at home pointed out to me, that these also can naturally be superimposed to form a nice zero momentum state. Which, as we said, the superconducting ground state we expect to be a zero momentum state. So now, next I'd like to consider the problem that was considered by Cooper. So I want to consider the wave function for a pair of electrons in the presence of a filled Fermi C. So we have electrons filled up to the Fermi surface, and then we add two more. And we're going to try to write down a wave function for those two electrons that makes best use of the whatever interactions they have between them. And it's only constrained by the fact that they can't mix with states that are already occupied. So I'm going to write it like this. And where so I'm not mixing in any states with k less than kF because they're all full. And for purposes of this calculation, I'm just going to assume that this is a real wave function. This is going to be a symmetric wave function under interchange of the two positions, which for electrons immediately means that their spins have to be in an anti-symmetric state because they're fermions. So spins So basically, this is a wave function which pairs k and minus k for the two electrons. So the Schrödinger's equation is call this 2EF. So this is the energy of the pair measured with respect to 2EF. Okay, so how much above 2EF this wave function will be for a particular set of Gs. Why what? Because we're adding two electrons. Oh, because it's the difference. In other words, it's how much above EF. So, okay, so if they were non-interacting, you'd add them at the Fermi energy, just above, but, you know, and the total energy would be 2EF. And the question is, when you put in the effect of these interactions, how much different is it from 2EF? If you choose, if you like, the best possible set of Gs. So if you put in the wave function, then this thing looks like okay, so that's, yep. I haven't said it yet.
Okay, that's the next thing.
Doesn't it look like there's any scale on which these are bound? Like those, it's a Pirot function, right?
You can't tell the scale on which they're bound. I mean, obviously, G is a function of K. If you knew it, that would tell you the scale on which they're bound. You mean the length scale?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you know G of K, you'll know that. Right, because then you'll be able to write out the function and graph it. Okay, but the point is that the G's of K's will depend on the interactions. Okay, I mean, if there weren't any interactions, then, you know, there'd be one of these for every K, and, you know, you just have plane wave solutions. Yeah, plenty.
How can two electrons be bound in such a stable way that it makes sense to talk about these pairs? Or are we just now, like, deriving them?
I haven't actually shown you that they're bound yet.
I
mean, typically, if you have two interacting particles, they'll just be in scattering states. Right? They won't necessarily be bound. In three dimensions, typically, even if there's an attractive interaction between them, it won't necessarily generate a bound state unless it's strong enough or the right shape. Okay. So I haven't said anything about that yet. In fact, the question is, if I give you a potential then will these things be bound, which will suggest some kind of instability, if you like. Because I would say that if they're bound, then they actually have an energy less than QBF, which...
So now we are modeling the interactions with that effective potential, and then looking what happens and seeing if there exists some bound state.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, but it's important to remember what this VKK prime is. In other words, you have this scatters you from a state K minus K into a different state K prime minus K prime. Okay, so it's doing that what we had in that picture. And V of K, K prime, or let's call it K, K prime, is equal to something like 1 over L cubed. I'm following Degen's notation, rho E to the I K minus K prime dot rho V of rho, where this is the potential in real space. And so now, this is the point at which Cooper made an interesting model for the scattering potential. Basically, what he said is so V of VKK prime is equal to minus some positive energy over L cubed, or zero. And this is if, I guess, what do I want to say? So this is a cutoff energy. And it's zero otherwise. So the assumption here is that you get an attractive interaction minus B if your two electrons that you put in are within some energy of the Fermi energy, otherwise you get zero. And that has to be true for both their initial states and their final states when they scatter, for both K and K prime. So this is a simple model which is cooked up to give you an attractive interaction and allow you to solve the bound state problem. That would be the phonon frequency in the phonon model, yeah. Now, I don't have time to work through to the answer here, but let me just write down what this gives you. this prime here implements this statement. So the K prime are only over states whose single particle energies would be within this cutoff frequency of the Fermi energy. Yeah? I wrote what? M, yeah, sorry. It's like 2M is like a name. Okay. So I guess we'll have to wait till next time to solve this for the G's. Stop there.
How well does this model work? This seems to be kind of a bold assumption to say that the interactions can be modeled in this way.
I think we're going to at least sketch out why, if it's an effective interaction that's mediated by a phonon, it's attractive for exchanging. Well, okay, it's attractive when the difference in the electron energies is less than the phonon energy, and it's repulsive if it's greater than the phonon energy.
I mean, how well does this model work in terms of numbers that you can go and measure in the lab?
Ask me again next time, but I do remember back in the old days when people were actually able to measure the phonon spectral functions associated, which were giving rise to the attractive interaction. They thought of this theory as being as accurate as QED. Okay. Now, I think that was a overstatement. Okay, but they were able to sort of like study the properties of the superconductor and then study the properties of the phonons, which gave rise to superconductivity and via the superconducting properties, and everything just was made to fit together perfectly. Okay, so it's said to be quite realistic.